Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Marty Johnson reporting. Turkey's Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu says the Islamic State group is the top suspect in Saturday's double suicide bombing in Ankara. Davutoğlu said that authorities are close to identifying one of the bombers and that the evidence points to a certain group. Thousands of people took to the streets of Ankara yesterday as the country mourned the victims of the twin bombings at a peace rally that killed at least 97 people. More from Dorian Jones.
It's the third fatal bombing aimed at pro-Kurdish groups since June. In July, 33 young activists were killed by a suicide bomber. The previous attacks were blamed by security forces on Islamic State militants. But in what observers say was a controversial move, the government refused to open a parliamentary investigation into the bombings. Saturday's double bombing is adding to a deepening polarization of the country as it heads to a general election in November. Destabilizing the elections is seen as a possible motive behind Saturday's attack. The fear in Turkey now is what else can happen before Election Day. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
The European Council is calling for Russia to immediately end military attacks in Syria that do not target Islamic State or other UN-designated terrorist organizations. An EU statement says recent Russian military attacks on the moderate opposition are of deep concern and must cease immediately. Russia claims to have hit 53 targets in the past 24 hours, which it describes as airstrikes on an IS training camp and underground IS facilities. Two twin suicide bombings killed at least 9 people and wounded 29 others in northern Cameroon in an attack local and security officials blame on Boko Haram militants. On Saturday, the Nigeria-based militant group launched 5 coordinated attacks in neighboring Chad, killing close to 40 people. This is VOA News. In southern Afghanistan today, gunmen riding a motorbike shot and killed a doctor who worked for the United Nations Assistance Mission. No one has claimed responsibility for the attack. The assassination of the doctor comes 2 days after the U.S. embassy in Kabul warned of attacks against the U.S. headquarters or possibly its offices in the Afghan capital on or about October 12th. Old City Jerusalem saw more violence today with an attacker trying to stab an Israeli policeman before being shot and killed. A spokesman for the Israeli Defense Forces said the attack happened near the Lion's Gate and that the policeman's protective vest fended off the attacker's knife. Today's attack followed violence in other areas on Sunday, including Israeli gunfire killing a 13-year-old Palestinian boy near a checkpoint in the West Bank, and violent demonstrations by Palestinians in Gaza. Iran's parliament has given preliminary approval of a bill that allows the government to implement a historic nuclear deal reached with world powers. Under the agreement, the Iranian government is authorized to withdraw from compliance with the deal if the other side fails to lift sanctions against Iran. Final approval of the parliamentary action is expected later this week. Meantime, Iranian state television is reporting that Washington Post reporter Jason Rezaian has been convicted on charges including espionage. The report quoted a judiciary spokesman saying the reporter and his lawyer are eligible to appeal the conviction within 20 days. VOA Persian service producer Human Bakhtir has more on the details and the lack of them in the verdict.
Non-Iranians, the trial process, in fact, the Iranian judicial system is very, very opaque. Even Iranians have a hard time understanding what goes on behind the closed doors because nothing is transparent. And there's no due process, evidence, no discovery process where the prosecutor has to give all the evidence presented to the defense. So it's very arbitrary, basically. And people now are speculating as to why Jason Rezaian was arrested 450 days ago on purely trumped-up charges.
Princeton University professor Angus Deaton has won the 2015 Nobel Economics Prize for his analysis of consumption, poverty, and welfare. The Royal Swedish Academy of Science has said by linking detailed individual choices and aggregate outcomes, Deaton's research has helped transform the fields of macro, micro, and development economics. The Nobel Committee says his work revolves around 3 questions, such as how do consumers distribute their spending among different goods, how much of society's income is spent and how much is saved, and how do we best measure and analyze welfare and poverty. It says his research has shown how the clever use of household data can shed light on issues. I'm Marty Johnson in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
On the one hand, global hunger index since 2000, in the 15 years, has come down by 27%. But hunger is still serious for the whole world.
That's Klaus von Grabmer of the International Food Policy Research Institute commenting on new Global Hunger Index report. Details coming up also in the news. Military authorities and eyewitnesses say Boko Haram suicide bombers have struck in towns and villages in Niger, Chad and Cameroon over the weekend, killing more than 50 people. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Douglas Mpuga filling in for Sunny, music from Sierra Leone and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, military authorities and eyewitnesses say Boko Haram suicide bombers have struck in towns and villages in Niger, Chad and Cameroon over the weekend, killing more than 50 people. In Niger, an Islamist extremist detonated hidden explosives, killing seven in the city of Difa when a policeman stopped him yesterday morning. In Cameroon, a government spokesman and military sources say two female suicide bombers killed nine people near the village of Kangalira in the far northern region early yesterday. They say the bombers were between 13 and 17 years of age. Officials say the death toll may climb. Nearly 30 others were wounded. In Chad, 33 civilians and five attackers were killed on Saturday in Baga Sola, a town on the shores of Lake Chad. Eyewitnesses say there were three explosions in the town's market and a refugee camp. The camp houses Nigerians who have sought safe haven from the 6 years of violence in their homeland. A Chad hospital source confirmed the death toll. A local government official says more than 50 have been reported injured in the attack in Chad. No one has taken responsibility for any of the attacks, although most authorities blame Boko Haram. The insurgents have attacked civilian and military targets in Nigeria for 6 years in an effort to carve out an independent Islamist state in Nigeria's northeast. In related news, a Nigerian Air Force spokesman says a pilot died when his fighter jet crashed during a thunderstorm in rural Adamawa State on Sunday. The plane was returning from a bombing ground on Boko Haram targets in the country's northeast. Hundreds of judges and lawyers in the United Kingdom have publicly chastised Prime Minister David Cameron's recent migrant policy. The criticism being published today in London newspapers calls the Prime Minister's response deeply inadequate. His critics caution that it ignores international law. Mr. Cameron offered to welcome 20,000 migrants within the next 5 years. Some of Britain's most senior retired judges and lawyers say the government's voluntary quota is too low, too slow and too late. They warn that such a modest commitment will drive the migrants into the arms of smugglers. Migration has become a major political issue for the government since Mr. Cameron's interior minister said mass immigration was damaging British society. Meanwhile, in Greece, Coast Guard's vessels have rescued more than 1,600 refugees and migrants crossing the Aegean Sea. The rescues were made in the last 3 days from 47 small, fragile wooden boats and rubber rafts. Many are refugees from years of war in Syria, Afghanistan and Iraq. The migrants are trying to reach one of several Greek islands in an effort to reach the Greek mainland. From Greece, they hope to travel overland to seek security and jobs in Germany and other European countries. A new report says The level of hunger in the world remains unacceptably high, with nearly 800 million people still going hungry. That's despite a decline in hunger levels in the developing world since the year 2000. The Global Hunger Index also says 1 in 4 children are affected by stunted growth and 9% are affected by wasting. The index also takes a close look this year at the relationship between armed conflict and hunger. Dr. Klaus von Grabmar is a research fellow emeritus with IFPRI, the International Food Policy Research Institute, from Berlin, where the report was released. He spoke to VOA's Jody Capua about the Global Hunger Index findings.
This report has many things, where one would say, on the one hand and on the other. On the one hand, Global Hunger Index since 2000, in the 15 years, has come down by 27%. But hunger is still serious for the whole world. Also, the global average of hunger being serious covers countries where the hunger level is alarming, and other countries where it's better. And even in the countries, sometimes you can have hotspots within a given country, although the country appears as not so alarming or pretty good. Within the country, you can have hotspots of hunger too. What we have to aim for is that the fight against hunger goes faster and more intense.
I see, according to the report, that levels of hunger remain serious or alarming in 52 of the 117 countries with global hunger index scores. Among the world's regions, South Asia and Africa, south of the Sahara, continue to experience the highest levels of hunger. Why those particular areas? Why is it more serious there?
Okay, let me start with the worst region, which is Africa, south of the Sahara. Globally, we have 8 alarming hunger level countries, and with the exception of 2, they are all in Africa. So the worst one is with a global hunger index score of 46.9, compared to the world average, much lower. So Central African Republic, the reason is armed conflict between 2001 and 2014. The next one is Chad. Chadian Civil War, 2005 to 2010. Then comes the country Zambia, which is the only country of these leading, or in the worst sense, leading African countries where there was no civil uproar. But there you have what the economists call the resource curse. You have copper and you have people who are not really interested in government to fight hunger on a decent level. So Sierra Leone would be the next in Africa. Then you have Timor-Leste and Haiti, which are not in Africa. But then comes Madagascar, and the last one on that list there is Afghanistan. So you have 5 countries out of 8, all in Africa. Out of those 5, 4, the reasons are either armed conflicts, war, civil wars, or other forms of violent uproar.
The new report talks a lot about conflict this year. Was that intentionally done, or did it end up happening because you were collecting all these figures and saw the effects of the conflict?
In previous reports, we also have mentioned conflict, but we have every year for the Global Hunger Index, we look for a special topic that influences hunger. Last year, it was hidden hunger and the fight against hidden hunger. Years before, it was equal rights for women. And this year, with all the conflicts going on, we thought we have a closer look. Whenever you have armed conflict, the farmers can plant their seeds, the crop can't be brought in, the infrastructure is not okay, the trade routes are blocked or destroyed. So the consequence of conflict on hunger is pretty clear and pretty strong. Sometimes you have conflicts stemming from hunger. You had that during the price crisis 2008-2009.
In the foreword to the report, it says, in the face of conflicts, both new and old, we must intensify our fight against hunger. How do you do that in the face of conflict?
In the face of conflict, it's very difficult. And it's also meant as a preventive way. If we double or strengthen our efforts in development cooperation and have situations where it's most unlikely that conflicts will arise, then it's easier. Once the conflict has arisen, then it's more or less later on curative work, and then you can go in with World Food Program or other institutions who humanitarian help. But the real solid work would lie even before that. It would lie in the investment into those countries and then building up with them solid infrastructures, talking with their governments and creating the political will to do changes. And we will also see in Africa, since peace in Ethiopia and Rwanda and Angola, they have become politically more stable and the hunger values came down significantly. It's not easy, but it can be done.
That was Dr. Klaus von Greppmer, is research fellow emeritus with IFRPRI, the International Food Policy Research Institute. From Berlin, he spoke to VOA's Jody Kepower. The Uganda military says its soldiers will begin a withdrawal from South Sudan this week. General Katumba Wamala told reporters in Uganda's capital, Kampala, that all Ugandan forces will be gone from war-torn South Sudan by the first week of November. Between 2,000 and 3,000 troops have been serving in South Sudan. South Sudan President Salva Kiir asked the Ugandan forces to come to South Sudan almost 2 years ago to save the nation's capital, Juba, from being overtaken by rebel forces. Kiir also raised the specter of a possible genocide at the time. Since July 2013, more than 2 million people have fled their homes. Tens of thousands have been killed in a civil war waged between Kiir's government and the forces of former Vice President Riek Machar. The two sides signed a peace agreement in August that permits Machar to return to South Sudan as Kiir's deputy. The withdrawal of the Ugandan forces was a major element of the agreement. South Sudan became independent from Sudan in 2011 after two decades of fighting. The UN mission in the Democratic Republic of Congo, MONUSCO, says it is looking forward to a full resumption of strategic cooperation with the Congolese army. The new head of MONUSCO is to arrive soon. Nick Long reports from Goma in eastern DRC.
The UN mission in Congo put a temporary halt to its collaboration with the Congolese army, the FARDC, in February after two generals suspected of human rights abuses were placed in charge of what was supposed to have been a joint FARDC-UN operation against FDLR rebels. Citing UN human rights policy, the mission withdrew support for that operation, although it has continued supporting the army against other armed groups. Saturday, DRC Communications Minister Lambert Mende said the government is waiting to resume talks with the new head of MONUSCO, Maman Sidiku, after what he described as certain difficulties encountered with Martin Kobler, Sidiku's predecessor. Kobler had been at odds with the authorities over the army's human rights record, freedom of expression, and preparations for elections. Mende also said the government hoped the new MONUSCO chief would listen more to the government's concerns, adding there might be less of a cultural communication problem with Sidiku, who is from Niger. MONUSCO interim spokesman Charles Bambara described Mende's comment about strategic cooperation as encouraging.
We have been asking this for quite months now.
He says, we've been asking for this cooperation for some time and it's going in the right direction. We're working to make sure all misunderstandings are cleared up so that this cooperation can resume as soon as possible. The human rights concerns that forced MONUSCO to pause cooperation can be resolved, Bambara suggested. The mission will continue to apply the UN due diligence policy on human rights, he added.
And I think that we have agreed now the way to solve this.
He says the UN has some principles and the principles will not change because of a change in the persons who are implementing them. Bambara also said the mission is trying to push the electoral process in DRC and calling for the government to allocate necessary funds to the Independent Electoral Commission. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma, DRC.
Zimbabwe has some of the highest rates of maternal and infant mortality in Africa. The Deputy Executive Director of the UN Population Fund, Kate Gilmore, was in Zimbabwe, where she launched a five-year, $680 million effort to address it. Reporter Sebastian Mumfu accompanied Gilmore to a rural health clinic to find out why mortality rates remain so high and what solutions are being proposed.
That is a newborn girl crying, born to 19-year-old Elizabeth Manyenga at Mausekwa Hospital in Marondera District, less than 100 kilometers southeast of Harare. 2 days ago, she felt the labor pains and started walking 10 kilometers to this hospital. I come from Patterson Farm near Mudam. I do not have an idea of how many kilometers it is from here. I arrived here the day before yesterday, and my delivery of the baby was smooth, very simple, and the hospital is taking care of us. She is one of the 6 mothers with newborns at the hospital, as UN Population Fund Deputy Executive Director Katie Gilmore arrived to showcase the new program. In an interview, Gilmore explains what is needed to reduce maternal and infant mortality.
Great health facilities, but most importantly, it needs great health workers. The more we can do on the health side of things, the more we'll see lives saved. But we then need to give women and men great education and information about birth spacing, and ideally keep young people in school rather than seeing girls married too early, long before they're able to manage marriage fairly. So they're both social programs and health programs that can save lives.
The United Nations says Zimbabwe's maternal mortality rate is about 614 deaths in every 100,000 pregnancies. The new program aims to reduce the maternal mortality ratio to 350 maternal deaths for every 100,000 live births and the infant mortality rate. About 5 years ago, it was at about 900 for every 100,000 pregnancies. Experts say shortages of skilled labor and absence of state-of-the-art equipment at hospitals are some of the causes of high death rates. Tawanda Borero, the chief medical official at Mauseka Hospital, says there is also a critical shortage of emergency vehicles. It is because of the ambulance shortage that Manyenga had to walk to the hospital when she started feeling labor pains. In some districts in Zimbabwe, ambulances take 3 hours to respond to a call, if there is a response at all. That results in mothers delivering babies at home where some die of hemorrhage, which the government says is the major contributor of death of women during delivery. Some hospitals have since introduced waiting homes for expecting mothers. Expecting women would come to hospitals in the last month of their pregnancy. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Marondera, Zimbabwe.
A new survey of more than 800 international businesses finds that corruption is still a major obstacle. Nearly 35% of respondents in Africa reported losing out on deals to corruption competitors. Control Risks, a global consulting firm, also says corruption risks continue to deter investors. Some 30% say they refuse to conduct business in specific countries because of the perceived risk of corruption. Maria Knapp is director of the Compliance, Fraud and Investigations Department at Control Risks. From London, she told VOA's Jody Kapowa that conditions would be worse if not for the passing of much anti-corruption legislation in recent years.
Our latest survey really highlighted that there's a consensus among the businesses that responded that international anti-corruption regulations, they've had a significantly improving impact on the business environment. It seems to have deterred corrupt competitors. It's made it easier for companies to operate in countries where corruption is still high. And interestingly, that's especially the feeling in countries with robust anti-corruption regulations. Companies that are operating from those countries feel that robust anti-corruption regulations actually gives them a competitive advantage. Companies out of Germany or the US, where there are really stringent regulations, they're feeling more confident doing business in difficult environments where corruption is still a problem. And our feeling is that from the survey, they're emboldened by the compliance programs and policies that they have in place as a result of these more stringent corruption regulations.
But you're still finding corruption to be a major cost to international businesses.
Corruption is still a major cost to international businesses, and it's still a problem. In a lot of countries, there is a particular issue around facilitation payments, for example, which is small bribes to speed routine governmental transactions. So they're quite commonplace in the most difficult environments. They're particularly difficult because they're accompanied with an implicit threat of either creating undue costs to the business or even grinding business to a halt. But there are more companies that seem to be refusing to pay facilitation payments more frequently through education and training programs in their anti-corruption policies are really getting to grips with how to handle that on a day-to-day basis and strengthening their sort of defense mechanisms.
Are there particular parts of the world where this is especially a problem?
Corruption is really, it's a human problem with a human solution. And there are countries where the local anti-corruption regulations are not as robust, but international regulations are actually coming in and filling those gaps. So there are countries where the frequency of, for example, bribery demands may be higher, but the problem is pretty much all over the place. And the international regulations are really reaching everywhere.
Are there particular types of industries that are targeted by corruption?
A particular point applies to respondents from two sectors with particularly high corruption risks. Just to give an example, from our survey, 39% of companies in construction or real estate, 37% of oil and gas and mining companies will choose to stay away from particular countries. So that exposure is a combination of the country risk, but also the sector risk. Here at Control Risks, we think it's vital to take both into consideration, that companies should not only look at the country that they're operating in, but it's a really good point that you're raising about sectoral risk. Sector risk, deal risk, strategic importance of a deal should all go into the risk assessment that a company will take into account when assessing their potential exposure to corruption.
As you mentioned, a lot of laws are now in place to battle corruption. In your view, what more needs to be done?
What needs to be done to tighten companies' ability to manage and hopefully to mitigate corruption risks is a continued active enforcement of bribery and corruption incidents by countries where it's the biggest problem, but also really the root answer is in companies themselves. So companies who over-rely on their programs and policies and feel a false sense of security going into uncertain and highly corrupt environments will have a lot of trouble, whereas companies that are really engaging with the corruption problem, carrying out risk assessments at an early deal stage, actively engaging stakeholders within their company about the issues, that's both people at the director level and frontline people who are actually experiencing corruption on a day-to-day basis, linking them together, those are the companies that are really succeeding in avoiding corruption without avoiding the opportunities that are available in some of the more difficult countries. The fact that there was previously a widespread perception that anti-corruption regulations were a costly burden and that they were encumbering companies' ability to compete on the international scene, there's been a step change in that perception since our 2006 survey, for example. The overall consensus has shifted to a view of anti-corruption regulations as helpful and as a really useful mechanism for companies to be able to engage in higher risk areas, but also for companies to use that process as a way of making more intelligent business decisions in higher risk areas.
Maria Knapp is director of the Compliance, Fraud and Investigations Department at the consulting firm Control Risks. From London, she spoke to VOA's Jody Kepua. This is African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America. This is African News Tonight on The Voice of America, and here is a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Boko Haram suicide bombers have struck in towns and villages in Niger, Chad, and Cameroon over the weekend, killing more than 50 people. Hundreds of judges and lawyers in the United Kingdom have publicly chastised Prime Minister David Cameron's recent migrant policy. And a new report says the level of hunger in the world remains unacceptably high, with nearly 800 million people still going hungry. Coming up, music from Sierra Leone, and in our feature segment, conditions set to worsen for 60 million hungry people across Africa as the El Nino weather phenomenon kicks in. I'm Yehi Suhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with the mighty Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sunny. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Yahya.
What's on the sports menu this evening?
Well, we take off with athletics. Thank you very much, Yahya. Despite windy conditions, Kenyan's Gladys Cheshire clocked a world-leading 10-kilometer time of 30 minutes 41 seconds at the Grand 10 Berlin on Sunday, becoming the ninth fastest woman ever at this distance. She was followed by fellow Kenyan Alice Namoununa and Ethiopia's Satuma Sefa Kabede, who ran world-class times of 31 minutes 02 and 31.11, respectively. In the men's race, world junior champion Joshua Kiptegei broke the Ugandan record with 27.50. Kenya's Philemon Cheboi and Ethiopia's Abeina Dagu Shahai were second and third, both given the same time of 28.05. Cheshire's victory continues the trend of the women's race, upstaging the men's at this event, following Joyce Chepkurkui 20.37 and 31.02 victories in 2013 and 2014. The 22-year-old Cheshire, who also took silver in the 10,000 meter at the All Africa Games last month, took 14 seconds off the world leading mark set recently by fellow Kenyan Perez Chepchikika.
Hello, sports fans. This is Paul Tergat, marathon champion from Kenya. You are listening to the Sony side of sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
Now, for more sports news, let's go to Johannesburg, South Africa, and join Daybreak Africa's Mark Ouma. Mark begins with the results of the Bank of America Chicago Marathon.
Kenyan Florence Kiplagat clocked 2 hours 23 minutes and 33 seconds to win the women's race at the Bank of America Chicago Marathon in the United States of America on Sunday. Ethiopians Yebgural Melese and Birhane Dibaba followed Kiplagat across the finish line. In the men's race, Dixon Chumba completed the course in 2 hours 9 minutes and 25 seconds to lead Sami Kitwara and Sami Ndungu in a 1-2-3 Kenyan sweep of the medal podium. Turning to basketball, Egypt's Gezira pipped Uganda's Oilers 75-73 to win the men's title at the Africa Zone 5 Club Basketball Championships in Kigali, Rwanda on Sunday. Rwanda's SPR edged Uganda's Tiger Head Power 82-77 in the bronze medal playoff. In the women's contest, Burundi's Berco Stars outwitted Uganda's Kampala City Council Authorities 63-52 to win the final. Kenya's outgoing champions, United States International University, dismissed Rwanda's Ubumwe 90-63 in the bronze medal playoff that preceded the final. Turning to football, hosts Ghana beat Equatorial Guinea 2-0 in Kumasi in the return leg of the African FIFA Women's Under-20 World Cup qualifier on Sunday. Ghana win with a 3-0 aggregate. Earlier on Saturday, South Africa edged Zambia 3-2 to progress on a 3-2 aggregate. Nigeria dismissed the Democratic Republic of Congo 2-0 to win on a 4-1 aggregate, while on Friday, Ethiopia stunned their hosts Burkina Faso 2-0 in Ouagadougou. Meanwhile, Egypt dismissed Zambia 3-0 as Nigeria outclassed Cameroon 3-0 in friendly matches on Sunday. Guinea edged Algeria 2-1. Tunisia and Gabon drew 3-3. Mali outplayed Burkina Faso 4-1 as South Africa pipped Costa Rica 1-0. Finally, Namibia suffered a 64-19 loss to Argentina at the Rugby World Cup in Leicester, England on Sunday.
Thanks, Mark. Mark Homer reporting from Johannesburg, South Africa.
This is Larry Zamude, Chairman, Chief Executive, Sports Radio 80.9, Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja, Nigeria. Let's talk to you about Brilla FM. It's Nigeria's only sports station. Of course, we partner that UA. VOA. And so you can listen to Sunny Side of Sports on 80.9 Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja. Keep listening, Africa, and enjoy Sunny Side of Sports on Brilla.
Thanks, Dr. Larry. In addition to Sports Radio, 88.9 Brilla FM stations in Lagos and Abuja, Dr. Larry also has stations in Kaduna and Onitsha, Nigeria. We're delighted to be your partner, Dr. Larry, so keep it sporty.
The Voice of America, VOA.
And now a programming, VOA programming note. Sunny Young is in Lagos and he'll be meeting and broadcasting with our friends at Brilla FM on October 13th and October 14th. Now in African football, Ethiopia won, Kenya drew and Tanzania lost in 2018 FIFA World Cup Russian qualifiers. They secured second round places with aggregate victories. Ethiopia face Congo, Kenya meet Cape Verde Islands, and Tanzania play top-ranked African team Algeria during November in a second home-and-away qualifying round. Another 10 second-leg fixtures are scheduled for Tuesday, after which there will be 40 African contenders left for 5 places at the World Cup in Russia. The top 27-ranked African teams, when the draw was made in St. Petersburg 3 months ago, received first-round byes, including Algeria and CAF Africa Cup of Nations title holders Côte d'Ivoire. For more on the qualifiers, let's join Nightline Africa's Shegun on the dot at DMA in Lagos.
All first-round, first-leg matches have now been concluded in the African qualifiers for the 2018 FIFA World Cup to be held in Russia. We'll give all the full results shortly, but first, the highlights. Chad scored an upset against Sierra Leone by winning 1-0 at home on Saturday. The 47th-minute goal brought the Chadians success in N'Djamena over opponents who are 54 places higher on the world rankings. Swaziland enjoyed a goal feast on Friday when it trounced host Djibouti 6-0. After taking the lead in the first half stoppage time, Swaziland banged another 5 goals past goalkeeper Gwede Hassan within 24 minutes in the second half. The result equaled the biggest away victory in a World Cup qualifier in Africa, with the Democratic Republic of Congo winning 6-0 in Djibouti in the 2010 eliminator. Djibouti is the weakest national team in Africa and the joint second weakest in the world, going by rankings. Somalia, another African minnow, lost 2-0 to Niger. The match was staged at the Addis Ababa Stadium because of ongoing clashes between the Somali government and Islamist forces. Central African Republic forced to play a home game against Madagascar in Antananarivo because of violence in the capital city of Bangui, suffered a predictable 3-0 loss. And making a rare international appearance, Eritrea fell 2-0 at home against far higher-ranked Botswana. All the 13 first-leg matches were concluded on Saturday. There will be another set of 10 matches on Tuesday. The aggregate winners will join the 27 top-ranked African teams in the second round of home and away eliminators in November. The 20 aggregate winners will then advance to the third and final round of qualifying. In that round, the 20 teams will be divided into 5 groups of 4 teams each. After playing home and away round-robin matches, the winners of each group will qualify to represent Africa at the 2018 FIFA World Cup. Let's now give all the results of the first round, first leg matches in the African qualifiers for the 2018 FIFA World Cup. Somalia 0, Niger 2, South Sudan 1, Mauritania 1, Gambia 1, Namibia 1, Sao Tome 1, Ethiopia 0, Chad 1, Sierra Leone 0, Comoros 0, Lesotho 0, Djibouti 0, Swaziland 6, Eritrea 0, Botswana 2, Seychelles 0, Burundi 1, Liberia 1, Guinea-Bissau 1, Central African Republic 0, Madagascar 3, Mauritius 2, Kenya 5, and Tanzania 2, Malawi 0.
Hi, this is VOA's Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. You're listening to my friend Segun Dot on the spot at Adeyemi and Nightline Africa Sports.
Thank you, Sonny. I'm looking forward to seeing you here in Lagos. Sonny and I will be meeting with our friends at VOA partner stations, 88.9 Brilla FM and Channels Television, here in Nigeria's commercial capital. Away from the World Cup qualifiers now, African soccer's governing body, CAF, says the kidney problems of its president, Issa Hayatou, will not prevent him from carrying out his full duties as acting president of World Football Governing Body, FIFA. The Cameroonian was named acting president after Sepp Blatter was suspended for 90 days on Thursday as a result of being placed under criminal investigation by Swiss authorities. Hayatou, who is 69 years old, requires regular dialysis sessions. But CAF pointed out that he has always carried out his duties without interruption as head of the African Confederation. Meanwhile, FIFA has said it will hold an extraordinary executive committee meeting in Zurich on October 20th. The meeting will discuss the corruption crisis, which has engulfed the governing body. FIFA has been in crisis since May, when U.S. authorities announced charges against 14 officials and sports marketing executives over bribery allegations amounting to more than $150 million. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
Thanks, Segun. That was Segun on the Dot Adeyemi in Lagos. And as just heard, many teams across the continent are scheduled to play their second leg fixtures tomorrow, Tuesday. And they are: Madagascar will host the Central African Republic, Burundi will host Seychelles, Sierra Leone will play against Chad, Namibia will play Gambia, Niger will play Somalia, Guinea-Bissau will play against Liberia, Lesotho will play against Comoros, Mauritania will play against South Sudan, and Swaziland plays Djibouti. And that's it for this edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. I'm Douglas Simpoga. Now back to your Hayas.
Thank you, Douglas. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, conditions set to worsen for 60 million hungry people across Africa as the El Niño weather phenomenon kicks in. And next, attempts to recycle trash in Lagos, Nigeria. But for some music, here is Steady Bongo of Sierra Leone with Mama Sayala.
Mama, do ya left to cry? Now God knows. for put you all and trust to Papa God. They give them a song. Who done no one picking? Nine God can get picking. Some never na he go to a na gota. Some never na he go put on na twele. Do ya make this no worry, oh mama? Keep on praying, prayers not a lie. Mama, do ya left for cry? Now God know I'm making all give you picking. Now for put you all. Trust to Papa God.
Cause I know born picking. And this I ego, it well me name. If you not able help me, do ya not well me name? And smile at the shape, all mango gets. And smile at the shape, all mango gets. It's so glad the way, then don't drive me na us. Today na you young, tomorrow go be me young. But go do ya. They beg you, do ya help me? For make I go get me deep. He's provoking, don't really need him on me.
Every day and night you dey cry, mama. Every day you dey cry, say God no give you pain. Mama most you don't regret and wait to make it born. Every day and night it begin to bring problems. Na so so wahala, mama swear because nothing on the way go make mama glad for pain. Get mama, look how they rough and like you no get papa. It's too shameful, it's too sorryful, it's too shameful, it's too sorryful. Hey Kalilu, you make your mama cry. Hey Kalilu, you make your papa shame.
The Red Cross is
Steady Bongo of Sierra Leone with Mama Sela. The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Society say conditions are set to worsen for 60 million hungry people across Africa as the El Nino weather phenomenon kicks in. Lisa Schlein reports from Red Cross headquarters in Geneva.
The Red Cross is launching an $8 million emergency appeal to assist more than 200,000 people in Gambia, Mauritania, Malawi, Namibia, Senegal, and Zimbabwe. The appeal aims to help the most vulnerable of the millions at risk. Africa suffers from chronic food shortages and is regularly hit with floods and drought that decimate harvests, leaving millions of people dependent on food aid to survive. The Red Cross says the situation is getting worse as the El Nino climate phenomenon is set to strengthen into next year. El Nino triggers extreme weather events and will likely increase floods in equatorial Africa and drought in parts of southern Africa and the Sahel region. International Red Cross Federation spokesman Benoit Carpentier tells VOA it is becoming more difficult for people to cope with food shortages because they have little time to recover from one weather disaster before another sets in. He says the focus of the agency's appeal is to try to help communities build resilience with small agricultural, seed distribution and livelihood projects so they can cope with the more frequent climate shocks.
What they build back every year is getting smaller every year. So that we are trying to tackle with these appeals that we've launched in these countries. But it's definitely, time is really ticking because as we were mentioning, the El Nino phenomenon is going to amplify those. We already see the impacts. We really need to act quite fast.
The Red Cross warns malnutrition rates are very high in Africa and the lack of nutritious food may be life-threatening for children, people with HIV, and other vulnerable groups. Carpentier says hunger may drive families to pull their children out of school and put them to work, and women might trade sex for food, putting them at risk of HIV. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The streets and lagoons of Africa's largest city, Lagos, Nigeria, are often clogged with trash, almost none of which gets recycled. As Chris Stein reports from Lagos, one company is trying to change that.
Adeyemi Okwoga is on the hunt for trash. Neighbors bring out bags of plastic and aluminum waste. He weighs them and carts them off, free of charge. Okwoga works for WeCyclers, a company that picks up recyclables from poor neighborhoods like Abute Meta in Lagos. WeCyclers co-founder and CEO, Bilikis Edebie Abiola, says the city produces about 10,000 metric tons of trash daily.
So all those trash, the black bags, you know, the pure water sachets that clog the drains, everything can be recycled. It's a raw material for people that have factories. So our goal is to collect all those materials using as cheaply as possible on a large scale and then give them to people that can use them.
At their nearby depot, WeCyclers sort and process their haul. They then sell off their recyclables to firms that reuse them. The startup has yet to turn a profit, but plans to press on and expand to also compost organic waste. The company awards residents points based on the weight of what they contribute. People can cash points in for gifts including plastic bowls, generators, and bicycles. Abute Meta resident O.O. Oladepo says her neighborhood is cleaner.
Now that these people are working, I think they make Lagos clean. You understand? Because Lagos is a dirty place. Most especially this can, pure water, and the plastic.
So far, WeCyclers only works in two neighborhoods in this massive city, processing about 40 to 50 metric tons of recyclables each month. That's not even 1% of the city's daily waste. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Kwame Ofor, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States welcomes Mozambique's recent announcement that it has completed clearance of all known fields of landmines in the country. Since 1993, when Mozambique emerged from decades of conflict as one of the world's most landmine-affected nations, the United States has been proud to partner with the people of Mozambique, investing more than $55 million toward improving the safety and security of local communities through the U.S. Conventional Weapons Destruction Program. Through that partnership, which includes the international donor community and humanitarian demining organizations, we have worked diligently to safely clear landmines and unexploded ordnance, prevent injuries through community outreach and education, and provide medical and social services to survivors of accidents involving these legacies of past conflicts. The United States is proud to be the world's leading provider of financial and technical assistance to help countries address this serious humanitarian challenge. Since 1993, we have invested approximately $2.5 billion in aid in more than 90 countries to decrease the threat posed by landmines and explosive remnants of war. Our efforts have dramatically reduced the world's annual landmine casualty rate and helped 16 countries declare themselves landmine-free. Humanitarian demining in places like Mozambique sets the stage for post-conflict recovery and development. It is another important way in which the United States promotes international peace and security.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.
Everyone is looking for something special when maybe they should just listen instead. The VOA's African Music Mix will soothe your nerves and calm your head. Tune in from 0 to 300 UTC and 1100 to 1300 hours UTC to make you feel good. So treat yourself to that something special.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band.